was about him being the first African-American appointed to the Supreme Court. Second paragraph talked about his work as a lawyer in the case Brown versus Board of Education. The very next paragraph said he was so offended by a particular National Lampoon article, he launched an FBI investigation into the writers. That's right. Somewhere, I have a file. By buying this audiobook, you have one too. Although we loved the National Lampoon job, Al and I were dreaming of bigger things. So after work, we'd moonlight on other projects, book proposals, TV pilots, hoping that something would pay off. At one point, we even wrote a screenplay for the rock star Meatloaf. When we turned in the script to Mr. Loaf, that's what you call the guy, his secretary told us, come back next week and we'll give you $5,000. We came back the next week and Mr. Loaf was gone. The office was abandoned. As I recall, they actually nailed boards up over the windows in case I wanted my money and was a zombie. This was my first movie job. My last movie job was in 2016. I sold an original screenplay to a very famous Oscar-winning producer. He still owes me $250,000 and he's not going to pay. The lesson here is you don't judge success by the amount of money you make. You judge it by the amount of money people are willing to screw you out of. 10 months after we started at National Lampoon, Al and I got another call asking if we wanted to come to Hollywood and write jokes for a new comedy. It's a film you might have heard of. It was called Airplane 2. Airplane 2. It was a comedy so bad it actually won an award in France. Now, esteem has risen for the film over the past few decades. Someone sent me a podcast recently where Quentin Tarantino raves about it, and the host keeps asking, are you sure you mean Airplane 2? The call to work on the film came from its writer-director Ken Finkelman. He had wanted our friends Tom Gamble and Max Prost, but they were busy, so they recommended us. You might remember them from Chapter 1. They turned down jobs on The Simpsons and recommended us for that. I owe my whole career to Tom and Max's bad judgment. Finkelman called us on a Sunday night. Monday morning, we quit our National Lampoon jobs, ran out on our New York lease, and flew to Hollywood. Our landlady, I think with some bitterness, sent only one box of our possessions out to Los Angeles. It contained winter coats. By Tuesday morning, we were on the set of Airplane 2. They were already shooting the film, and whenever a joke wasn't working, we were told to come up with something funnier and fast. We worked in a tiny wooden shed right on stage, which was baking under hot studio lights. It was basically a sweat box, the kind they send unruly convicts to in southern prison movies. It was tough, high-pressure work, great training for our future jobs in TV. And we got lots and lots of jokes in the final film. We also got to hang around with the all-star cast, which included many very nice people, and William Shatner. Years later, we'd repay our debt to Ken Finkelman, getting him a staff job on The Simpsons. He spent some time in the writer's room, decided he didn't like it, and quit after 2 hours. That's a Simpsons record. Where's Johnny? After Airplane 2, Al and I got another job writing the script for a black comedy set in Vietnam called Cowards. Al sent a copy of it to an actual Vietnam vet who said, I'd like to kill whoever wrote this. The vet got his wish. The script killed our careers. The film never got made and we were finished in the film business. The next movie job we had was writing The Simpsons movie 20 years later. It was 1984 and we were out of work in Los Angeles, a town where we knew nobody. Al was applying to business schools and I was considering a career in alcoholism when we got a call from The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. The head writer wanted to hire us pending an interview with Carson himself. When we stepped into Carson's office for the interview, we found it set up exactly like The Tonight Show set. We sat on the couch, Johnny sat behind a desk, and we chatted for about 12 minutes, the exact length of a Tonight Show segment. Carson made a joke, we laughed, and he sent us on our way. If he could have cut to an Alpo commercial, he would have. The job was ours, and we were thrilled. But for Johnny, these were dark days. He was pushing 60, he was 2 decades into his show, and he was going through his 3rd divorce. He was so isolated from his writers that we had to read the National Enquirer to find out what was going on in his life. One day the cover story was, Johnny's ex demands $5,000 more a week in alimony. Mickey Rose, who was the co-writer of Woody Allen classics Bananas and Take the Money and Run, turned to another Carson writer and said, that's funny, between the two of us, we make $5,000 a week. The accountants must have noticed that too. A few days later, both writers were fired. The Tonight Show was a tough gig. Al and I were expected to write 60 jokes a day. 60 jokes a day. What if you get writer's block? Well, if you work for a nightly show, you can't get writer's block. Why should you? Other professions don't have this luxury. A plumber doesn't come to your house and say, I can't fix your toilet. I have plumber's block. And an accountant never says, I can't do your taxes, man. I have H&R block. Audience, boo! Where did they come from? Every day, the 5 writers would turn in 60 jokes to head writer Ray Siller. From these 300 jokes, he'd select the 18 best. Of those 18, Carson would choose his dozen favorites. That's right, 12 jokes chosen from 300 submitted. Only 4% made the cut. Still, night after night, 1 out of every 3 jokes would bomb. It was the same thing during my years running The Simpsons. 1 out of 3 scripts bombed at every table reading. No other business works like this. Campbell's cans say, great work, boys. Only 1 in 3 cans of our mushroom soup poisoned anyone. At Samsung, do they say, congratulations, fellas. Only 1 in 3 of our phones exploded. Actually, they may say that. One night, Johnny was doing Karnak, the classic routine where he gives an answer followed by the question. A guy named Kevin Mulholland wrote what is considered the best Karnak ever. Answer is, sis boom ba. Question. Describe the sound made by an exploding sheep. I'm proud to say I wrote the worst Karnak ever. The answer was, red square. And the question was, what do you call that blotch on Gorbachev's head? For you young people listening to this, I'm not going to bother explaining who Gorbachev was or what was that thing on his head. Suffice it to say, the joke sucked. And yet somehow this gag made the final cut from the hundreds of Karnaks submitted. When Johnny performed it on the air that night, it was met with a profound silence. The audience didn't dislike the joke. They had no idea it was a joke. 6 months later, Johnny was doing Karnak again, and through some horrible clerical error, he chose the same joke, Red Square. Johnny read it, and it got a huge laugh. Same basic audience, same performer, same setting, same joke, but with a wildly different response. I learned a valuable lesson that night. There is no science to comedy. David Cohen, the co-creator of Futurama, agrees with me on this, and he is an actual scientist. I will admit there are 2 things that always got a laugh on The Tonight Show. When you call Dynasty star Joan Collins a bitch, and the word McNuggets. So Al and I wrote a joke. Joan Collins has gotten a job working for McDonald's. She's endorsing their new product, Bitch McNuggets. Now that's not funny. I'm not sure it's even a joke. But Carson read it on the air, and it got one of the longest laughs in Tonight Show history. How do I explain it? Well, this was the 80s. All of America was on coke. Here's Joni. I love the weeks Joan Rivers hosted The Tonight Show. Every morning she would send us a list of topics for that night's monologue. For example, Wednesday, the topics were cheerleaders, Roman Polanski, Beverly Hills High School, and Madonna's wedding to Sean Penn. For that last one, we submitted the joke, as part of her outfit, she's got something old, something new, something borrowed, and a blue movie she once starred in. One evening, we heard that Joan's husband, Edgar Rosenberg, had had a heart attack. We wondered if she'd even do the show the next day. I mean, who'd expect her to? The next morning, we got her list of topics. Thursday, Edgar's heart attack, Edgar's lousy doctor, Edgar chasing nurses, and shopping for a funeral dress. The sitcom life. 2 weeks after Bitch McNuggets, Carson fired us for no apparent reason. 2 weeks after that, he offered us our jobs back, again for no apparent reason. But Al and I had already moved into sitcoms, writing for Sledgehammer, a new parody series about a Dirty Harry-style cop. It was unique and irreverent, which are both crimes in network TV. ABC punished the show with one of the worst time slots in TV history, Friday nights at 9, competing with Dallas and Miami Vice, the two biggest hits on the air. Still, Sledgehammer hung on through two seasons and still has a nice cult following today. Since the show was shot on film without a studio audience, each script was like a little movie. The experience taught us to write cinematically, creating montages, quick cuts, and parodies of film tropes. We would put all these skills to use later on The Simpsons. We jump from Sledgehammer to ALF, a show about an alien hiding out with a family in suburbia. ALF, which stands for Alien Life Form, was in fact a puppet voiced and operated by show creator Paul Fusco, one of the most talented men I ever worked with. More importantly, the show was something new in our careers. A hit! One thing we would take from ALF to The Simpsons was its suffusion of pop culture references. In the pilot for ALF, there was a line that every critic at the time singled out. When the family on the show is fighting, the father cries out, "Have we learned nothing from the Cosby Show?" In 1987, this was a groundbreaking line. As Matt Groening once noted, people on TV never seem to watch TV. It's one reason our opening credits end with the Simpsons family piling onto the couch to stare at the television. ALF's pop culture obsession reached a peak in an episode where the alien dreams he shipwrecked on Gilligan's Island, his favorite TV show. We assembled a majority of the cast as guest stars, Gilligan, the Skipper 2, the Professor, and Mary Ann. For a child of the 60s, this was a dream come true. I got to write jokes for Gilligan and hit on Mary Ann. Because ALF was a show with a puppet, we knew kids would watch it even if they didn't get the jokes. This freed us to write our scripts purely for an adult audience. One episode was an hour-long parody of The Tonight Show, which was on 3 hours past most kids' bedtimes. I got to reuse a lot of old Carnax on that one. This was a lesson we took to The Simpsons. Don't write the show for kids. Write it for the parents who will be watching with their kids. ALF didn't pioneer this, by the way. Mad Magazine never worried about what its audience might understand. It once did a cover story on A Clockwork Orange, an X-rated film that its core readers were too young to see. Years later, The Simpsons would do a Halloween show that parodied both A Clockwork Orange and Eyes Wide Shut, the Stanley Kubrick X-rated double feature. If your kids have seen these movies, I'm calling Child Protective Services. I can trace this refusal to write down to your audience to Rocky and Bullwinkle, a show everyone on The Simpsons grew up watching. Apparently, the writers of that show, including Jim Brooks' old writing partner, Alan Burns, felt that the show's animation was so bad, the only way to save it was in the writing. As such, Rocky and Bullwinkle was a mix of silly puns and sophisticated Cold War satire. Villain Boris Badenov was a nod to Boris Godunov, the 16th century Tsar region of Russia. Get it, kids? Of course you don't. After a year on ALF, Al and I went off to work on It's Gary Shandling Show, a show about a guy who knew he was on a show. Even the theme song was self-referential. This is the theme to Gary's show, the opening theme to Gary's show. The set was an exact replica of Shandling's actual living room. People don't realize how much of The Simpsons came from It's Gary Shandling Show. More than half our original writing staff, Sam Simon, Jay Kogan, Wally Wolodarski, Al Jean, and me, had done time on the series. The show was as unpredictable and self-aware as The Simpsons would be. The Shandling Show also pioneered the use of the random guest star. For example, Jeff Goldblum and Tom Petty had recurring roles as themselves, playing Gary's wacky neighbors. The Simpsons would do this later, but Shanling did them first. Although we bounced from job to job and took whatever came our way, all these sitcoms taught us valuable lessons that we were about to use on The Simpsons. Sitcoms. When a writer is considering whether to take a sitcom job, there are two basic criteria. What are the hours like, and how long is the commute? The hours on sitcoms vary wildly, from 35 hours a week to more than 100. And the work week can be 5, 6, even 7 days. 8 days a week is not just a Beatles song. It was the work schedule on Arrested Development. Their offices were next door to The Simpsons, and their writers seemed to work every single hour of every day. I used to imagine sweating workers in South African diamond mines saying, "This is bad, but it beats working for Arrested Development." At The Simpsons, the work schedule has ranged from 40 hours a week to more than 80. It all depends on who's running the show. We currently have two writers' rooms running simultaneously, and they have completely different schedules. One gets out by 6 p.m., the other room stays late but gets free dinner. I opt for the free dinner. This being Los Angeles, the commute is just as important, because it doesn't matter that your day is short if you're going to spend 3 hours a day in rush hour traffic. In L.A., rush hour is considered any hour of the day or night. It's Gary Shandling's show was beloved by critics, but they didn't have to work there. The offices were way over in East L.A., and most nights we got out at 2 a.m. By these standards, ALF was the best job I ever had. I was out at 7:30 every night and home by 7:45. Now you may be asking, what about the quality of the show? Isn't that a consideration? Hey, that's funny. You could write sitcoms too. Act 2. A Simpsons plot, which begins at the very end of Act 1, takes over in Act 2. Simpsons' second acts often take up half the show. As this Act 2 opens, I've left It's Gary Shandling Show to work at The Simpsons. This section will take you behind the scenes of the show. You'll meet the writers, the actors, the animators, the producers. You'll learn step by step how we make the show. By the end of Act 2, you're going to be sick of the friggin' Simpsons. Chapter 4, Meet the Writers. 95% of the work on The Simpsons isn't writing, it's rewriting. One person will write the script, but then it will be endlessly rewritten by a gang of writers. Generally 4 to 6 people pitching jokes all day in one large room, the writer's room. I worked briefly in a writer's room with 27 other writers. Absolutely nothing got done. People were afraid to pitch. If you made a joke and no one laughed, you had just bombed in front of a pretty decent-sized crowd. A writer's room is a delicate thing. It's not enough to be funny. You also have to get along with everyone. One irritating or obstinate writer can bring the whole machinery of a show to a halt. I learned this long before The Simpsons, when I worked with a writer who was very talented, but also an a-hole. The A is for ass. Eventually, the boss called him in and said, "We love the work you're doing here, but everyone thinks you're an asshole. We're going to have to fire you unless you can, you know, stop being an asshole." The guy said, "Let me think about it." He went home that night and returned the next morning. He said, "I discussed it with my wife and she agreed. I can't stop being an asshole." The current Simpsons writing staff consists of 23 very funny non-assholes. People expect our writer's room to be a raucous madhouse, but it's not. It's a serious place of business. Every few years, a news program sends a camera crew to observe the Simpsons writers at work, and every time the crew gets bored, then angry, and then storms off without a second of usable footage. This is because our writers aren't clowns or performers. They're introspective, hard-working people who will spend 2 hours trying to think of a title for an itchy and scratchy cartoon. Winner? Of Mice and Manslaughter. These are not wild men. The Simpsons writers are mostly family guys who are American dads, and one mom. None of us were Barts when we were kids. We were all Lisas, good, hard-working students with very few friends. And then one day we woke up, and we'd suddenly become balding, paunchy Homers. I'm not kidding when I say every writer's favorite day is Friday. Why? Because that's free donut day at The Simpsons. In 30 years, the most exciting thing that ever happened in our writer's room was when a writer got so frustrated because we couldn't get a joke we needed that he punched the cardboard box. His hand was torn and bloody, and the box was barely creased. That's our best story. A writer got in a fight with a cardboard box and lost. Most of our current writing staff have been coming in, day out for more than a dozen years. It gives the place a small-town feel, like a Mayberry or a Springfield. Everyone knows each other's business. And just like a small town, we're starved for novelty. When one of the writers shaved off his mustache, we talked about it for the next 2 years. These cats are squares, Daddy-O, but man, are they funny. After 30 years at the show, I still walk into work intimidated by how sharp the other writers are. I rank myself as the 8th funniest guy in the room, and I'm happy to make the top 10. I can't compete with Joel Cohen, a low-key guy from Calgary with the fastest mind alive. When we need a joke, say a funny name for a nail salon, Joel will have spit out 3 pitches while the rest of us are still considering the problem. Then, he'll make a joke about how lousy his first 3 ideas were and pitch 3 more. Jesus, Joel, the other writers moan, which is the best compliment you can get. Our writers sprang up like genetic anomalies all over America. Only one is from a comedy background, Jay Kogan, whose father wrote for the Carol Burnett Show and, more impressive to us, Mad Magazine. The rest of us are from small towns very much like Springfield. Utica, New York, New Canaan, Connecticut, Wilmington, North Carolina, Farmington Hills, Michigan. Showrunner Mike Scully is actually from Springfield, the one in Massachusetts. How did they get to The Simpsons? Well, no writer has ever been hired without providing a writing sample first, no matter how impressive his resume or how well we know him. He must submit a spec script, a sample episode of an existing TV show like The Big Bang Theory or Curb Your Enthusiasm, that demonstrates that the writer can construct a clever, original story and knows how to write good dialogue in the style of known characters. I always tell aspiring writers, your spec script is the last good writing you ever have to do. The strange thing, though, is that the spec script is never meant to actually be produced, and you almost never get a job at the show you wrote the script for. I broke into the industry with a Golden Girls script, and that got me my next 4 jobs. But the Golden Girls didn't like it. And I don't think anyone's ever been hired at The Simpsons off a Simpsons script. In 1992 and 93, when I was running the show with Al Jean, I read over 800 spec scripts a year. 400 Seinfelds, 200 Cheers, 100 Murphy Browns, and assorted others. About 700 of these specs were good, but what I was looking for was great. I wanted a script that was funny from the first page to the last. I noticed how so many writers, in a hurry to finish, let the quality drop in the last few pages. I needed closers. This was the tedious process by which I found great writers like Greg Daniels, the creator of The Office, and Bill Oakley and Josh Weinstein, who 3 years later had my job running the show. In both cases, they had written pitch-perfect Seinfeld scripts. Greg's was set entirely in a single parking space and was so good that Seinfeld actually produced it. Bill and Josh's script had George Costanza accidentally swallowing a jagged piece of glass at a party. All of the guests stay for hours, waiting to see if George passes the glass safely. It was cringe comedy at its very best. I also rejected some very talented writers whose spec scripts weren't up to my standards. Some of these people would get hired later at the show and do great work. There's current Simpsons writers John Frank and Matt Selman, and Futurama co-creator David Cohen, who may be the best Simpsons writer ever. He's the man behind the fans' all-time favorite episode, The Itchy and Scratchy and Poochie Show. The Simpsons writers are scary smart, too. Ken Keeler has a PhD in applied math. Jeff Westbrook has a PhD in computer science. Bill Odenkirk has a PhD in inorganic chemistry and helped create 2,2-bis-di-dienyl-biphenol, a ligand used to make organometallic complexes, you dumbass. And then there's Dan Graney, a graduate of Harvard Law School, where he and another student edited rival publications. "Well, look at you now, Dan," I told him. "You've got a cool job writing for The Simpsons. What's become of your rival?" And Dan replied, "He's Barack Obama." Bill Odenkirk, by the way, is one of three Simpsons writers with famous funny brothers. Bill's brother is Bob Odenkirk of Better Call Saul. Writer Mark Wilmore's brother, Larry, hosted The Nightly Show on Comedy Central. And David Stern's brother is actor Daniel Stern, the tall burglar who repeatedly gets the crap beat out of him in Home Alone. Al Jean. When someone asks the secret of a great writing team, I always say, find a brilliant partner and make him do all the work. Al Jean was my writing partner for 17 years. How brilliant is he? Here's an example. Once during a writing session, I pitched a joke. They're at the nursing home, and Grandpa says, "I want to watch TV." And Jasper says, "Who died and made you boss?" Grandpa says, "Fred," and he points to an old man lying on the ground, clearly dead and clutching a TV remote. Everyone laughed and was about to go into the script when Al held up his hand. He said, "I think we did it before." Then he told the writer's assistant to pull up a certain script. She has all 600 episodes archived. Now, Al didn't say, pull up the script where Grandpa gets a girlfriend, or pull up the episode called The Old Man and the She. He said, pull up script 7F17. That's the 17th script of our 7th season. The writer's assistant put up 7F17 on the TV monitor. "Go to page 30, Al says. 31, 32. And there it was, the same joke in an episode we had produced 23 years ago. Al didn't take a victory lap, he just went, "Let's keep pitching." Al is my best friend and my best boss, and he was the best man at my wedding. I met him the first week of college. He was passing by my dorm room and saw a rocking chair inside. "Would you mind if I rocked in your chair?" he asked. It was an odd request, but he seemed harmless. He rocked for 10 minutes and left. And this is because Al Jean rocks. Not in the way the new iPhone 10 rocks. That's product placement. Please send me a crate of free phones. Al rocks in rocking chairs. He rocks in straight back chairs. Legendary sitcom producer James Comack once said of him, "That kid rocks like an Orthodox Jew at prayer." I once gave Al a rocking chair for his birthday, and he rocked it to pieces within a week. It's not an artistic quirk. It's not an autistic quirk. He just likes it. When Al came to Harvard, he was taking pre-med courses, intending to become a doctor. But soon enough, I lured him into comedy with my tales of the Harvard Lampoon. I told him the parties were great, which they were, and filled with beautiful women, which they were not. Thanks to my bad influence, Al Jean became one of the preeminent comedy writers in TV history. You're welcome. Otherwise, he'd have become a doctor and have cured cancer by now. And probably Alzheimer's. I'm sorry. From 1981 to 1998, we wrote everything together, one line at a time. Of all the hours side by side, we fought maybe once a year. And it was never over our own material, but about implementing some stupid note a network executive had given us. If you want a good picture of how the team worked, see Topsy Turvy, Mike Leigh's great biopic of Gilbert and Sullivan. Gilbert is Al, tall, serious, hard-working perfectionist. Me, I'm Sullivan, the shrimpy, merry, procrastinating partner. After seeing the film, Al was stunned. He said, "They even looked like us." Al is a great comedy writer, but he would have been great at whatever he devoted that massive, throbbing brain to. Farming, pharmacology, interpretive dance. But it could all have gone horribly wrong. Al read about another guy who had the exact same bio as his, a small-town kid from Michigan who came to Harvard at age 16 to study math. It was Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber. Who knows? If Kaczynski had been a little bit funnier, maybe he'd be running The Simpsons today. Or at least The Big Bang Theory. Oh, this is embarrassing. Al Jean on Mike Reiss. I've known him for 40 years, and he's always an amazingly brilliant, funny guy. Morning, noon, and night. People would say, does one of you write the jokes and the other write setups? Does one of you do more structure and the other more dialogue? Really, we'd just go line by line. We would start on a story and say, okay, how do we start? And one of us would say something, and if we both liked it, it would usually go in. John Swartzwelder. John Swartzwelder, writer of nearly 60 Simpsons episodes, doesn't give interviews, go to parties, or do Simpsons DVD commentaries. As a result, he's taken on a mystique that combines J.D. Salinger, Banksy, and Batman. John wasn't seeking this persona, but it amuses him deeply. There's even an internet fan theory that John Swartzwelder doesn't exist. It's just the name we put on episodes that are group written by the Simpsons staff. Someone once called Swartzwelder the Thomas Pynchon of the comedy world, which is oddly appropriate because both these recluses have appeared multiple times on The Simpsons. Pynchon played himself in two episodes. Swartzwelder appears as a background character in many scenes. He's the guy who looks just like Wild Bill Hickok. In addition, for some reason, one Springfield park has a statue of Swartzwelder sitting on a horse. And for some reason, he's wearing a spiked army helmet. By the way, Swartzwelder loves using the phrase, for some reason, in his scripts. It justifies the unjustifiable, for some reason. I hate to demystify him, but he's a normal person, a strapping, friendly man who will chat endlessly about guy stuff like baseball and old westerns. His clothing and political affiliation are conservative, he smokes unapologetically, and he reminds you of one of your father's friends. But while John is mostly normal, his writing is not. He's responsible for a huge number of truly crazy Simpsons episodes, like the one where Bart gets an elephant, or where Homer becomes a henchman for a Bond villain, or where Marge... Well, he never really liked writing for Marge. And he'd often forget to put Lisa in scripts. But he seemed to be able to effortlessly channel Homer. His secret, he said, was to write Homer as a big dog. Here's an example. In one episode, Homer is in prison. Here's a fun fact, by the way. After 30 seasons, every single member of the Simpsons family has been to prison. Many of them twice. Anyway, Marge has baked Homer a cake with a file in it and delivers it to him. And Homer wolfs it down, file and all. At this point, Swartzwelder proposed that a long, pointy object begin to emerge in the back of Homer's pants. We asked him, just to be clear, you're saying that while Homer is talking to Marge, he's slowly shitting in his pants? Swartzwelder replied in his Gary Cooper-like cadence, yes, sir, that's what I'm saying. Not all this craziness was confined to his scripts. Swartzwelder would often make pronouncements like, the best exercise is to run 10 feet as fast as you can and then stop short. Or, Lorne Greene, the star of Bonanza, invented rap music. Or, Abraham Lincoln was an asshole. He made these declarations with such confidence that he was sure everyone agreed with him. One of the Simpsons writers, Jennifer Crittenden, left the show to work on Seinfeld. If a line was needed for Kramer, she would often pitch something Swartzwelder had said. It always got rejected. Too crazy for Kramer, the other writers would say. John Swartzwelder is a normal guy, but he's crazier than Kramer. Conan O'Brien. I've known Conan O'Brien since he was 19 years old, and stardom hasn't changed him one bit. He was always an arrogant prick. That's a joke. He's warm, modest, and the funniest man on earth. I first heard about him when I was working in New York at National Lampoon. I got a call from a younger friend at the Harvard Lampoon saying, we just elected a guy on staff, and he's like nothing we've ever seen. They said his name was Conan, so I asked to speak to him. I said, Conan, eh? Conan the Barbarian? I wasn't being a jerk. I was being a parody of a jerk, which is still kind of jerky. I said, where's your sword? Where's your broad axe? Conan replied, I don't have a broad axe, but I like Al Brodax, producer of the Popeye cartoons. It was an insanely obscure reference, but he knew it, and he knew I'd know it. I call it comedy telepathy. You probably call it geekiness. Shut up! When Conan got out of college in 1985, I recommended him for his first TV job. HBO sketch show, Not Necessarily the News. He was then writing with future TV titan Greg Daniels. They were hired as a team, splitting scale, the lowest salary you can legally pay writers. It was the greatest bargain in TV history. A decade later, we hired Conan at The Simpsons. He was our first new writer since the show began in 1989. Al and I put him to work rewriting a script that had problems. The legendary never-to-be-produced episode where the rock star Prince visits Springfield. Conan did such a good job that we had him fix another script, and then another one. Finally, John Swartzwelder told us, after witnessing Conan slaving away, I saw the new guy working in his office. He looks like a dog being punished. We finally brought Conan into the writer's room, and he instantly took it over. He pitched great jokes. He entertained the staff. It was a non-stop show from 10 in the morning till 2 at night. When he came to his first story meeting, he sold 3 ideas to the producers, including the classic monorail episode, and that's a record that stands to this day. He left The Simpsons a quarter century ago to do his own talk show. He's hosted the White House Correspondents Association dinner twice and the Emmys 3 times. But he says people still ask him, when are you going to write another Simpsons? Sooner or later, he'll come crawling back. Conan O'Brien on Work at The Simpsons. I love making Mike laugh. Of course, he was always trying to make me laugh, too. But I just remember it feeling aspirational to get Mike to laugh because he has such a great one. Sometimes I wouldn't even say anything. I would just make odd noises to make Mike laugh because when you're in the Simpsons writing room for 15 hours, subsisting on fried food, you just look for ways to make your comedy elders laugh. I remember they used to make me perform for them at The Simpsons. I was like their pet monkey in the room. I would do different things, a whole spectrum. The stupidest thing was I would fill my mouth with Coca-Cola and then would violently shake my body so I would look like I was having a wild fit, foaming at the mouth. I would really go for it. I remember they're really enjoying that and then applauding afterwards. How do we make the show? It takes us 9 months from concept to finished product to make a single episode of The Simpsons. Like that other 9-month process, pregnancy, it starts off fun and ends up painful, messy, and expensive. The procedure involves 23 steps. By contrast, performing a liver transplant takes only 8. So if you get bored reading about our process, feel free to bail out at any point. Just skip ahead to the end to see how you rank. Number 1, the pitch. Once or twice a year, the writers meet in a conference room to present their ideas to the executive producers. The bosses kick each idea around, and if they approve it, they bang a gong. This is the only whimsical thing that happens in the whole process. Number 2, the script. The writer goes home for 2 weeks to write the script. It's about 45 pages long. Number 3, the notes. The showrunner annotates the script thoroughly, noting what must be changed. Number 4, the rewrite. 6 to 8 writers sit together with copies of the script trying to address the notes. They all pitch jokes until something makes everyone laugh. That's the line that goes in. The writer's room is a democracy where you vote with laughter. It's like a kibbutz, only more Jewish. Number 5, the re-rewrite. Once a room full of writers has revised the script, it is handed off to a second writer's room for a final polish, and then a second final polish. Number 6, the table read. The writers, the staff, and their guests, maybe 60 people in all, gathered to hear the cast perform the script in a large room. At least 2 cast members are not there and read their parts on the world's tiniest speakerphone. The writers mark their scripts, noting which jokes got a laugh from the audience and which didn't. They also get a sense of whether the storylines work and all the writing is true to character. Number 7, yet another rewrite. Armed with this info, the staff goes through another rewrite and another polish. Number 8, the record. The cast comes in a few days later to record their lines. They are directed by one of the writers and perform 4 or 5 versions of each line. Number 9, the audio edit. The best take on each line is chosen, and a complete audio version of the episode is cut together. It runs about 20 minutes and plays like a radio show, complete with placeholder music and sound effects. Number 10, the design. A writer works with the animators on designs for the episode. New characters, props, and costumes have to be drawn and approved. It's much more laborious than it sounds. For example, it's easy to say the Simpsons are at a costume party, but the designers have to determine who's at the party and what costume each attendee is wearing. In the early days, everything had to be designed. The first time we had rain on the show, we had to figure out, what does Bart wear in the rain? How about Lisa? Does Marge have an extra long umbrella to cover her hair? What does Simpsons rain even look like? Is it drops or lines? Is it yellow? Number 11, storyboards. Animators assemble a 300-page black-and-white storyboard, basically a long comic strip. It contains drawings of every key shot, action, and emotion in the script, with the dialogue pasted below. The showrunner, the script's writer, and particularly Matt Groening make detailed notes and fixes. This is the last step before any animation begins. Number 12, the animatic. 2 months after the table read, the writers and animators pack into a small room to watch the animatic. This is a roughly animated version of the storyboards synced up to an edited audio track. It's like watching an episode of The Simpsons animated by cavemen on a tight budget. Number 13, the animatic rewrite. Based on reaction to the animated screening, the writers do another rewrite, fixing jokes that don't work, tossing out whole scenes and adding new ones. Up to a quarter of the script is changed at this point. Number 14, animatic revisions. Actors come in to record new lines, new scenes are storyboarded, and a new audio track is assembled. Then the whole mess is ready to be shipped off to South Korea for full animation. Number 15, Feng Shui. Gene Wong, a Los Angeles Feng Shui expert, examines the revised animatic to determine if it is in harmony with the series as a whole. She will then bless the show with incense and incantations. Number 16, not really. Ignore step 15. We don't do that. Number 17, animation. Our team of Korean animators hand draws the 24,000 cells to make one episode of The Simpsons. These days, color is added by computer, but for the first decade of the show, each cell had to be hand painted. Backgrounds must also be designed and composited with the foreground animation. This process takes 2 months. Number 18, color screening. The writers and animators meet in the screening room to see the finished animation and judge which scenes and jokes work. A joke from the first draft must get a laugh 3 times from the same group at table reading, animatic, and color to stay in the show. Number 19, color rewrite. A day is spent rewriting the color version. This is surgical work since new animation is costly. Typically, 10% of the script will be changed, re-recorded, and reanimated. Number 20, editing. The revised color episode is edited for pacing. Then the showrunner picks the spots where music and sound effects should go. Number 21, scoring. Our composer devises an original score for the show. A single Simpsons episode may have as many musical cues as a feature-length film. The composer then records with a full orchestra. Number 22, mixing. In a day-long process, dialogue, music, and sound effects are combined into the final version of the show. Matt Groening and the producers will spend hours adjusting sound levels, making sure everything is as clear and funny as it can be. And finally, number 23, air. 4 days after the mix, the show is aired. Then we rerun the living crap out of it. It's that simple. It's taken 9 months and 8 full rewrites to bring a single episode to air. About 80% of the script has changed from the first draft. Sometimes not a single line remains from the original script. If a writer fights to preserve his original script, he'll probably get fired. There's no room in this process for ego. Oh, and by the way, we have to do all this 22 times a year. How many steps did you listen to before you bailed out? 1 to 5 steps? Ha ha! 6 to 10 steps? Doh! 11 to 15 steps? Underachiever and proud of it. 16 to 20 steps? You are a true Simpsons fan. 21 to 23 steps? Nerd. Story retreats. A story retreat is like New Year's Eve. It's how we kick off each season of The Simpsons. And like New Year's Eve, it was fun when we were young, but now it's something to be dreaded. The procedure never changes. Every writer comes in with a pitch for a new episode. Then the rest of the staff, particularly James L. Brooks, riff on the idea until we decide we have enough for an episode. Brooks is almost supernaturally good at creating stories. You give him an idea and he'll instantly spin out the whole episode with jokes, plot twists, new characters, and a sweet and satisfying ending. Al and I once pitched a germ of an idea. Marge takes an art class and churns out depressing Edvard Munch-like paintings. The family realizes she's secretly unhappy. From that nugget, Jim instantly spun out the plot of Brush with Greatness, in which Marge is commissioned to paint Mr. Burns' portrait. Unable to find a way to make him sympathetic, she ultimately portrays him as twisted, frail, and nude. Jim told the story with the ease of someone recounting a TV show he saw the night before, even laughed, surprised by his own jokes. Occasionally, an idea is shot down for being either too bland, like Simpson's Visit Detroit, or too weird and arcane, such as the episode where Marge is kidnapped by Frenchmen seeking to restore the Bourbon monarchy. But just as often, a truly bizarre idea will get approved, such as an entire episode told by tattoos crawling all over Homer's body. I should note this idea was approved but never produced. Later it wound up in Moana. Where do these ideas come from? From TV, magazines, movies, and our own lives. In one episode, Lisa drinks the water on an It's a Small World type ride and begins hallucinating violently. We didn't make that up. It happened to our writer, Kevin Curran. Of course, Lisa did this when she was 8 years old. Kevin was 32. In another instance, one of our writers went to China to adopt a baby girl. We didn't say, that's great, or congratulations, or she's beautiful. We said, oh, we got to do that on the show. And so we did an episode where Patty and Selma went to China and adopted a baby girl. The next year, the same writer went back to China and adopted another baby girl. And he came in and we said to him, dude, we did that episode already. So he went back to China and returned the baby. Finally, from my own life came The Tale of the Clown Bed, a story that so tickled Matt Groening he insisted we use it on the show. In 1992's Lisa's First Word episode, Homer builds Bart a bed shaped like a clown's body with a headboard painted to look like the clown's head. While the idea of a child sleeping on a clown's midriff every night is pretty weird, it's the headboard that made it awful. Homer has painted it with an unintentionally ghastly clown face. The finished bed scares the crap out of Bart, who sits up all night quaking and chanting, "Can't sleep, clown'll eat me, can't sleep, clown'll eat me." The clown bed was so memorable it made a return appearance on the show 22 years later. It also pops up in two Simpsons video games and as a popular GIF. My father built the original clown bed for my little brother John back in the 60s. The clown face my dad painted may have been even scarier than Homer's. The eyes were two soulless black pits. The nose was a weird pink color with black flaring nostrils. It was so creepy, my mom insisted the head be removed. It wound up leering in the back of a closet like a scene from the movie It. My brother spent the next several years sleeping in a headless clown. In the early days, story pitches were a couple of minutes long, a premise, a few sample jokes, and a conclusion. Over time, these pitches have swelled to become detailed 15-minute presentations. Many writers even bring in visual aids. One woman brought musical accompaniment. Al Jean once circumvented the whole process. He plopped a finished script on the table and said, "Here's my pitch." As the pitches become more elaborate, the settings in which we pitch become more Spartan. Nowadays, we do these sessions in a conference room on the Fox lot. But in the early days of the show, we'd hold them in a luxury hotel suite, often with an ocean view. This is why these story conferences are called retreats. At the end of the day, if one of the writers had a girlfriend, a rare occurrence back then, he'd get to stay in the suite for the night. The greatest part of any retreat was getting a story approved. This was celebrated by banging a huge ceremonial gong. We used to get one from the studio prop department until Fox began asking if gong rental was a necessary expense. Bean counters. After that, we started using a small gong someone stole from a Chinese restaurant. When that got stolen from us, we would bang the lid on an ice bucket. Now we just wrap a fist on a tabletop. I'm often asked if I'm afraid the show will run out of ideas. It's never a concern of mine. It helps having a big writing staff. 23 writers have to produce 22 stories a year. This means that every writer only has to have one good idea a year. If my math is correct, it also means that one guy doesn't have to do squat. I am that guy. Jokes that never quite made it. The Simpsons has so many running jokes. The location of Springfield, Bart's prank calls, Burns' hound releasing, Lenny getting severe eye damage. But there are some that haven't caught the public's fancy. Even our most obsessive fans haven't picked up on these. Now they have something new to obsess about. Here's one. Homer is an expert on the Supreme Court. We've mentioned this a couple of times. For some reason, Homer knows the names of all our chief justices. Another one. Skinner wears a toupee. He does. We just never show it or mention it. We put the jokes in, but they always get cut. The lone vestige is one of Bart's chalkboard gags, where he wrote, "The principal's toupee is not a frisbee." Here's a funny one, Marge's father's death. We thought that every time we mentioned Marge's father's death, there would be a different funny cause. He got drunk and fell off a roller coaster. He was eaten by a bear at the circus. None of these jokes was funny enough to make the final cut of the show. Finally, in season 27, we said he died of lung cancer. Hilarious! Sometimes I can't fathom why jokes don't make it into the script. For example, once we wanted Marge to be reading a news magazine about tar. I won't explain that. We needed a name for the magazine, and I pitched Tar Nation, as in, what in Tar Nation? Everybody seemed happy except Al. "Nah," he said, rejecting it. "Nah," echoed writer George Meyer, incredulous. But I wasn't mad. Someday, somewhere, someone will need a name for a weekly tar magazine, and I've got one. Another bit you never saw was a long scene with Lenny and Carl discussing Ted Danson's forgotten sitcom, Becker, as if it were as great as Star Trek. They knew every bit of trivia about the show, they called themselves Beckies, and they were planning to attend a big Becker convention that weekend. The writer's room loved it, but you probably had to be there. The showrunner at the time walked in and cut it instantly. He also cut another bit we liked, a character named Gravy Wallace, who loved gravy. That was it. Gravy Wallace loved gravy. Maybe the showrunner was right, and maybe it was stupid, but maybe gravy could have been the next Disco Stew. There's always a joke. I'm not a spiritual man. I don't believe in ghosts or astrology or reincarnation. And if the Dalai Lama is so godlike, why does he need glasses? Although I'm Jewish, I'd happily eat a ham sandwich with mayo in a synagogue on Yom Kippur. I have only one supernatural belief. No matter what the setup, there's always a perfect joke for it. It may not be a great joke, but it's always the right joke for the moment. It's there in the universe, waiting to be discovered. I came to this conclusion after we spent 3 hours trying to come up with a certain joke on The Simpsons. Here's the setup. Homer enters Lisa into the Little Miss Springfield pageant, and she wins. She becomes an outspoken activist. We based her on Jane Fonda. And pageant officials fear she's turning into a liability. They scan Homer's entry form looking for a mistake so they can disqualify Lisa, and then they find... what? We pitched longer on this joke than any I can remember. Some suggestions made Homer look too stupid, others were too lazy. Worst of all, none of them were funny. We were stumped. We knew Homer's mistake had to be an innocent one, but one so undeniable that it could get Lisa eliminated. This was the resolution of the whole episode. By 1 a.m, we were exhausted, frustrated, and ready to settle for a lame joke. Or no joke at all. That's when a writer named Frank spoke up. Frank wrote great scripts, but he rarely spoke. He was a Buddha-like man who would plop himself into a chair first thing every morning, shut his eyes, and go silent. He was either meditating, sleeping, or dead. In any case, we'd whisper around Frank all day, not wanting to disturb him. But on this particular session, just when we were about to give up, Frank opened his eyes and said, in the space marked, "Do not write in this box," Homer wrote, "Okay." Perfect! Weeks later, Frank would pitch another great joke. It was a Troy McClure driver's ed film called Alice's Adventures Through the Windshield Glass. Then he went back to sleep. Since the Frank incident, I've always believed that the perfect joke is out there if you're willing to spend the time searching for it. And sometimes you have to think outside the box, although that's a cliche. Anyone who says think outside the box isn't thinking outside the box. For one script, we needed a funny name for a family restaurant franchise. Some of us pitched parodies of TGI Fridays. Too bad it's Mondays, thank Allah it's Ramadan, and so on. Other pitches burlesqued cutesy names like the Old Spaghetti Factory. There was the Corn Dog Conglomerate and the Lasagna Limited Holding Corporation. The problem with making jokes from a formula is that they sound formulaic. Then George Meyer piped in with his restaurant name. The Texas Cheesecake Depository. I have no idea where that joke came from, but I know where it went. Into the script immediately, and into syndication eternally. George pitched another great restaurant joke, but we never found a spot for it. In a diner serving chicken wings and potato skins, hangs a sign reading, "Thank you for eating our garbage." I can only think of one time where the Simpsons writers settled for a joke they knew was subpar. We were working on 1992's Three Men and a Comic Book, the episode which introduced Comic Book Guy. The character seemed so marginal, we didn't even bother to name him. It was past midnight, and we were getting ready to leave, when one writer asked, "Shouldn't we name his store?" We pitched for a while and finally came up with The Android's Dungeon and Baseball Card Shop. This is what writers call a wacky stack. A string of funny words they hope will somehow become a joke. I figured it was good enough since we'd only see the comic book store this one time. Since then, we've shown this shop and it's not quite funny sign in dozens of episodes. I'm embarrassed every time. They've even built a life-size replica of the store at Universal Studios.